All right, oh, people. This was a fucking good episode.
Really was. Like, it's not for the timid. NFTs.
You know, what I really liked about speaking with Arvin on this episode was a very grounded conversation. Like, that went by so fast for me. And this realm of NFTs and Web3 and all this is usually confusing for me. And this conversation was very clear. I was like, I didn't feel ever lost.
Yeah, me either. And he was a wealth of knowledge. And if you think NFTs are dead, well, then you need to listen to this episode.
Well, also, I really appreciated, spoiler alert, the element of value being attached to the utility of something.
Yeah. And there's ways that these things have a possibility of contributing to our culture and our society and our economics. Even.
Yeah. And then Mark planted the seed of overtaking the world with the Illuminati.
Yeah. You'll have to wait till the end of the episode to hear about that for sure.
Yeah,
but so. Just remember to subscribe.
Yeah.
And then thank you to our sponsors, Adrenochrome Cola, and keep supporting the Compton Cowboys and the show, because you never know, we might take over the world.
Two outlaws on the lam, taking the back roads through America.
You can't drink enough coffee for this show.
And now it's time for Monday Madness with the Moped Outlaws, Greg and Mark.
And welcome to another episode of Moped Outlaws, the wildest ride in the West. Today, we are stoked to have our guest, Arvin Kamse. He is a powerhouse entrepreneur, someone who has chosen a powerful road forward. He has created a life for himself. His life story is really interesting, and I don't know how deep we'll get into it, but he is creating some amazing things in the art world, but also in his personal life and in his economic life. And it's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a wonderful.
And you're calling us from Dubai today, is that correct?
Dubai today, yes.
Yeah, how's the weather over there?
It's nice, honestly. Like, otherwise I would have been in Vancouver, Canada, and I don't like the weather there. So every time you ask me here, it's always nice.
Yeah, I have some friends in Dubai, and it's amazing how clean it is and how modern safe. It is and safe. Like, you can walk alone at night. Yeah.
I mean, you say walk alone at night. There are people, I mean, some of my friends, they don't lock their car, they don't lock their house. You leave your stuff somewhere, like at some coffee shop, come back 5-6 hours later, doesn't even get touched. So,
wow.
Yeah. And this is a contrast to where you grew up as a young boy. Am I right? Like, tell us a little bit about your journey, how it started in Iran as a young boy.
So I've actually, I mean, that's a big contrast. I've lived in several different countries. I certainly lived up until I was, let's say, 17-ish in Iran. So between Tehran and somewhere outside it. And I went to this school that was for higher than, let's say, average IQ. So it's like, you can think of it as just like a, let's say, alternative to Mensa, if you know what that is. And then, but that was the schooling for that, for it has its own schooling. And anyhow, but it was funny because, so imagine the nerdiest, kids, let's say like more intellectual kids, right? And they placed that school in the roughest neighborhood in the town, where like even cops barely even would dare to even, you know, go there. And it's actually, it's almost like a troll to the,
nerdy kids. Yeah.
But, it was very rough. Like, I mean, one of the reasons I actually got into martial arts and things like that is because, as a hobby, not professionally, but or maybe let's say lifestyle. But it was just because it was crazy. Like I would see people getting stabbed, you know, daily. But then, having said that, though, like I have friends in you know, we were talking about London earlier on. I have friends in London. They say the same thing now. You know, like they just stabbing is such a big issue in the UK, but especially like, for example, London. So anyhow, yes, contrast, big contrast as far as like safety. And then later on lived in the UK actually for some time myself, lived in US for some years, actually LA, New York, different places. So yeah, lived everywhere. And I think one good thing that did for me as someone who's going to later on get into like investment finance is just understanding real estate everywhere, you know? So I have a very good understanding of just because living, you know, and also just paying at least minimal attention to what's happening around me. So I think that's been a blessing.
So before we move on from that part of the story, there was a organization in Iran that really made an impact. It was No Debt, NODET.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us a little bit about that and what you think the importance of those kind of organizations are to the future business leaders.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is like literally what I was mentioning to you guys. That is the organization that has, just to give context to people, because I don't think this is something like people can find from Google. So the way it works is about, let's say, 40%, 50% of the population in each city, they go through one set of exams. And then, so basically they need to be pre-qualified first, and then they go into that first exam. And then out of those, let's say 10%, or 5% get accepted. And then there's more. So there's like two more exams. And so it just gets qualified further and further. And then imagine out of like millions of people, there's about 30 people that just get accepted.
So now then, the school?
Yeah, that is it. Yeah. And okay. I actually never talked about it online. I've never heard anyone else talk about it online. I guess there's not that many people. But so I mean, some of the friends that, so I was hard worker. That's how, I consider myself smart. I would also say very hard worker. So I think that's how I was in there. But then there were some people in there that were, I would say, unusually smart. Like, you know, they're just the genius people you see in the movies. They're not really social. They're kind of weird, you know? So there was a lot of people like that too. And, you know, some of them got into like inventing things. Some of them got into working for even like different countries, governments, different things. So it was just a very, let's say, isolated environment compared to everywhere else. But then again, it was awesome because we got to do things on a level no one else and then I guess age group also matters here. So you get in from age about, let's say, 10. And from 10 until, let's say, 17, 18. And so you essentially have like a different path to the average schooling process. So like instead of the secondary school, high school, things like that, then you have your own thing. Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, at least they set us the expectation that like you got to do something great, you know, in the future. So that's good.
Yeah.
So setting the expectation for greatness is a really important piece about developing our youth.
Yeah, absolutely. And as opposed to just be like, well, you know, a standard is just like you survive, or like your standard is, let's say, you just have a, you know, be able to just provide for your family and then die. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's different levels. So, yeah.
I think we have a joke in our society about handing out awards to children just because they were there.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. We were certainly not that kind. Yeah. Like they would on a daily basis, they were almost committed to kick us out. Wow. So like they would do exams on a daily basis. It was just it was like an army, except for like, let's say maybe like mind, you know? So very disciplined, very, very cool. And then, to be honest, I don't know what's happening with it right now. I mean, it's obviously been many years. So, but it's wonderful. It's a really good contribution. I would say, like, my friends, like, you know, looking at their life right now, I would say, like, it's different, you know, to, let's say, average, average, not meaning below, like a meaning average path, for someone else who didn't go there. So, but I guess it's like similar if like someone saying like, you know, they went to Harvard, you know, right. It's not the same, but it's like similar, the concept, right? So like the networking you get, the opportunities you get, the, I mean, in my case, there wasn't any opportunities I got, but you know, what I'm saying is like, you, at least, they set a standard for us to look for them, you know?
Right. So. Right. Like, yep. It's not a standard that you currently live by that was created as you were developing as a youth.
Yeah. Yeah. Big deal. Big deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say so.
So what, why did you leave Iran then?
Oh, so, and this is kind of crazy. So I actually, let's say just going through my schooling, everything was great. And then, one day my dad just, pulled me to the side and he goes like, you should go and, go to a different country, you know, and then just, go and see what's happening outside your own little bubble, basically. Right. And of course, I was very like resistant to it, but funny enough, not resistant for the reason maybe people would think. I was, like, usually someone in that age, if you tell them, hey, like, go travel on your own, if you've never lived on by yourself, and just go somewhere else in a different country, don't know the language, don't know anything, right? So you just go settle down somewhere else on your own. I would say they would just be terrified. I was actually more concerned about, like, you know, because so people, obviously, it would have been a different language, right? It would be the English language, right? Right. So, I was actually more concerned. So in a school, I had a lot of friends. I was very close to my friends and we would laugh a lot. We would, you know, we would joke about things and just laugh a lot. And then my biggest concern when my dad actually told me, you know, he wanted me to actually go some other country. And in this case, it was the UK. My biggest concern was like, what if they don't understand my jokes? And like, he wasn't like, oh, how are you going to live there? You don't know the language. Like, what about housing? Are you going to make money there? Like, you know, none of those things actually came to my mind, which is hilarious. But, obviously worked out, you know, it was difficult, just jumping into something completely new. But then I think maybe even the school set us up for things like that, you know, right. We'll just be like, yeah, let's go.
What was the logic of your father's choice at that time?
Yeah, so he was not necessarily an entrepreneur, but he did go a different path to what his dad wanted him to go. And then he did travel actually different countries himself. And then I think what he got out of that, he realized it's a big value. And I would say just living in multiple countries myself, let's say people in Dubai, I mean, not talking about like Emiratis, but people in Dubai, I would say they've traveled different places. Cause most people actually here, like for example, last year until now, I think there's an additional 100,000 people just came to Dubai. So it's a lot of people, right? But, I think a lot of people are actually coming from elsewhere, right? And so, but then versus, let's say in the US, right? So a lot of people I mean, I went to college, in the US and a lot of people wouldn't travel, right? So I think there's my dad saw something in that, concept of traveling and then also just throwing me into live a life and just figure things out. I think equivalent of that, sometimes people, you know, some, I guess parents, maybe dads, they send their kids to like the army, right? And then you learn discipline, you learn values. For me, that was it. You know, it's not this, I'm not comparing to the army at all because thanks for the service and everything they've done, but, it is a way to also figure out life, figure out values. And I would say that's why my dad did it.
So your father saw it in the choice. It was a developmental element. He was like, my son needs this in order to develop. All right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very cool.
And clearly having a sense of humor is the key to success.
Yeah. And I just continue. Honestly, it's, I just, I was making fun of my friends and or just laughing with them so much. One day in school in actually New York, this happened. They just pulled me to this improv club. And then I fell in love with it. I just was like, this is probably the best thing ever done. It was terrifying, obviously. Like, you know, you go on a stage, especially if language is not your, you know, English is not your first language, right? So, because you can't like quickly come up with things like other people would do. But it was the best thing. It was the best thing happen. And I actually continued. I mean, this year I didn't do it, but maybe later on in the year, I'll do some more shows. Just hobby, you know, it's fun.
Do you do stand up also?
No stand up. Just the improv. Yeah. In the US also it's a thing, obviously, like improv comedy versus, let's say, in Europe, I don't think they appreciate improv comedy as much.
And in Dubai, it doesn't exist.
To be honest, I haven't looked. I would. Yeah. But I did my shows in LA, in the Upright Citizen Brigade, if you guys know what that is.
Okay.
But, yeah. No. This is a
good big
national theater. Yeah.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was just going to say that rings a bell. Of course, I've heard of Groundhog. That's, I think, the improv group that's really big in LA.
It's a thing. It's like a cultural thing in the US. It just matches it, you know, where I think in the Europe, maybe they don't appreciate the same type of, I mean, I don't know if you watched the Curb Your Enthusiasm, like that whole thing is actually improv.
Yeah. But
like, Larry David.
Right. But whose line is it originated in UK?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, that improv show. Who's like, I think it, and then they brought it to the United States.
Awesome. I guess from my own personal interactions with people in the UK, I always found that they don't laugh at the, like, not my jokes. I don't care if they look at my jokes, but just when I watch other people they watch it too, they don't find it funny. And so I found that maybe it's just like a cultural difference, but I could be wrong. Yeah, you're right.
So you're in the NFT space in your recent career. I'm curious, has anyone released comedy NFTs, like with audio and jokes that you know of?
I don't know, but if anyone's listening and want to do this, hit me up. We'll laugh for sure.
Maybe you and Joe Rogan
maybe
should have
we'll
a conversation.
Well, in the NFT too. No, I'm kidding, obviously. But I haven't seen anything in the comedy side of things. I could come up with some ways of actually making it, you know, make sense. So for example, let's say if it's a piece of content, it's recorded and you want to, instead of just publishing it on YouTube, maybe if you turn it into an NFT for specific types of people, or maybe a specific, maybe it's like a 1 hour, let's say improv. And then, there's a 10 minutes at the end. That's also like funny and just like very entertaining, but you cut it off the YouTube and then you say, hey, if you want it. And so as like all the other, like 10 minutes of some other clips of, you know, other shows. And then maybe like a meet and greet with the, you know, master of the jokes himself and all the, it's just things like that. And then just make it actually really valuable, you know, and I think people who are interested, I would buy it.
You know? Is right now in the NFT market that meet and greet element, that sort of VIP element, an important part to a collection having value?
Yeah, I mean, Trump did it. So, and he did it multiple times, you know?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
So
what I was wondering is, like, could you approach the Pryor family, Richard Pryor, and create a collection? And obviously the VIP element isn't available because he's passed away. But do you think a collection of audio clips from Richard Pryor could be an NFT collection?
Yeah. The collection itself, maybe even having an ownership to some pieces, maybe even some pieces that haven't been public, maybe stories from the family. Just so many things you could do and just make this really really valuable. And in the Trump example, so I did actually advise the group that launched that Trump collection for another collection that they had. Not gonna name, but also good, also really cool concept as well. And then so they actually made it so that if you bought 45, I think, NFTs, the first one, because they've done a few, if you bought 45 NFTs, then you would get to meet at like the Florida's resort with Trump, like for a dinner or something.
Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, and it's, you know, for this is a fan base everywhere. You know, it's, that's not new, right? We're just using technology to do this. And I think also like, just to clarify for someone who doesn't know me, I think you initially said, in your new career, my career wasn't improv, like just to be clear for people. That's just a hobby. I've done it. I continue to do so. My actual career, is actually marketing. So that was my initially what I got into, and, did that up to, I want to say 2021 I started from small companies all the way to large companies, public companies, Fortune 500 companies, and then, especially investor relationship marketing. And then, you know, got into the NFTs, but just so it's clear, so people don't think like comedian turned into an NFT, right? Yeah.
Do you think the pandemic aided in NFTs?
And yeah,
it did.
Yeah. So pandemic is, so I have also an Airbnb operation. That's in Canada now, looking potentially expanded to a few other countries, like maybe Dubai. It's, UAE and Dubai to, be one of the places, but, the pandemic did a lot of things. I mean, now we're just kind of talking about like what it did. Cause at that point, no one wanted to talk about it. You know, like everyone was just either so sad or like so excited about the profits, you know? Yeah, exactly. Either way, it was just don't want to talk. Right. But yeah, obviously now it's people reflecting back. So Airbnb, a lot of people, like, I mean, I heard today from someone, you know, they're in Chicago, for example, apparently they went from, I think it was like 15,000 to 5,000, like overnight. So 15,000 people who 15,000 let's say short-term rentals went to 5,000 overnight in Airbnb. Wow. And you know, that's like a big difference, you know, especially if you have a like a good size. So yeah. So yeah, a lot of habits. So point is, a lot of habits changed, right? So the in this specific scenario was people wouldn't travel as much. And then, so holidays became a weird concept. And then, the other side of it was, okay, so if they're not doing that, so what are they doing instead? For example, you stay at home, maybe more, maybe they go watch more social media. So actually, the advertising, had its own time as well. So like, the price you would pay per 1,000 impression, that changed significantly, right? So everything changed, actually. Everything changed. Now, specifically with NFTs, so NFTs, I would say hype, the peak of it was around, let's say, October, November 2021. And that's when it was like the best time. Like there's one of the people I worked with, she was... I think she was maybe 20 something year old at that time. And, she never made a single dollar online, to her name before that time. And then, in about a month and a half, she made, about 10 million. Yeah.
Is that is she still a multi?
She's still around. Yeah. She's still around. Yeah. I wouldn't name it obviously, right. But, right. Yeah, she's still around and things like that. I mean, so, and how much of it was COVID? How much of it was NFT? I think it was like a combination because people weren't doing a lot of, let's say, going out as much or maybe certain things. They stayed at home and then they would watch these opportunities, right? So now one of them was NFTs at that time. Like my sister at the time, she was making 20K a month just flipping NFTs, and she doesn't have experience in business at that time. So, And my sister wasn't alone. Like there was a lot of people. I mean, even myself, I did that, but at least I was in a different background. So, it definitely impacted. I think it to simplify, I think it created more hours for people to be in front of opportunities. That's how I would say it.
Yeah. Well, with Bitcoin halving coming up, there's kind of been a turnaround in their market. It's going a little bit more bullish. Yeah. And I'm wondering what you think would need to happen for NFTs to turn from bear to bull.
Yeah. So this is very interesting. Obviously, I think about this all the time. And I don't know if Bloomberg was trolling me or they actually genuinely wanted to know this, but they were asking me about an article they want to write of why NFTs are dead. And then they reached out to me and I'm just like, really, like, you guys couldn't just find someone else. but anyhow, obviously the narrative at that time, I actually agree with them. Funny enough, I agree with them that the narrative for the NFTs, them being just profile pictures, or let's say at the time was overpriced JPEGs, that has died. I agree. I would say it's died. But new narrative is going to come. I think the new narrative is, I would say two different scenarios that I can see. And I see people who are getting into that. And then obviously because of the market sentiment, as you were saying, is becoming more and more positive. Then there's a chance that it becomes hype, at least for a short amount of time again. There's a chance. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't, but at least, I would say those two things are, one is the essentially service-based businesses turning into token gated communities. So example of that is in my own collection. If you think about usually people buy a subscription model to, let's say, get crypto signals from some trader, right? So I brought a bunch of traders with my co-founder, bunch of traders into one place. We built a community around it and we token gated the community, meaning you have to have the NFT to be able to access the community, get the crypto signals. I think this kind of membership based, that's token gated. Mm. That's gonna be here because there is no other way to do this. You can only do it with NFTs. And doing it with NFTs is way more valuable because technically people who got our crypto signals, then they can go sell the NFT later after let's say a month, 2 months, maybe they hate us, you know, they can sell it at same price. Okay. So you still got your services, without paying essentially. They could sell it at a larger price. So you got our services and you made money. And they could sell it at slightly lower. And you practically for free, you got services and you made money from the crypto and whatever. And then if it's like completely goes zero, I mean, it's possible, but it's not likely because, it's not based on, like the project, these kind of projects, they're not based on just the crypto like hype. They're based on the actual utility. Right. Yeah, obviously that could happen. But then again, you would have paid for the trader anyways, right? So now at least there's an opportunity. So I think that's one side of it. And the second side is tokenizing real world assets. So like real estate, art, things like that. So. I think that's
there's like three major tokenized global platforms. So you can buy the art in a blockchain, or you can buy the land in a blockchain format, right? There's like two or three of them. Do you have any holdings in those? Have you experienced anything with those?
I do have a real estate portfolio, but not on blockchain, and nothing to do with blockchain. I know someone really well and who is who has and it's a project in it's a platform in Dubai. I can't remember the name to be honest, but essentially they I think it's like 500 or 5,000 people anyhow that they bought into this, let's say, one bedroom, you know, and they have like five or six projects. So total they've done, but this is one of them. And then they rent it. And then people who have, based on the number of NFTs you have, you receive, just some money, you know,
like it's a not dividend, much. Sort of.
Yeah, exactly. It's more like a reward. So like they distribute the rent toward, I guess, a percentage right. of the rent across, amongst all the holders. It's not much, but it's cool, you know?
You're saying, in essence, an NFT blockchain membership is a representation of a percentage ownership of a business opportunity.
It could be, not in the scenario I was mentioning, because in that scenario, it's more like it's an alternative business to subscription, right? Subscription model. But it could be also that. It could be that and also essentially having an ownership to the company. So let's say my company with my co-founders, Galaxy Pals, let's say people come in, it's token-based community to receive the services that we have, in this case, Crypto Signals. But then they could also, it's not the case in our case, but I'm saying, let's say hypothetical, it could also mean that they would also share, it could also mean that they would buy a share into the company itself. And then if the company like exits, you know, 10 years down the line, then, you know, whatever profits they would make from that and or just being invested in company, you know, at a smaller level. Now in art, the way it looks like is, I think best to think of it as like, let's say for, art that is, very, let's say, not very expensive, but let's say above average people can handle, right? So let's say $5 million piece, right? It's not usually bought and sold by average person. So then if you tokenize that, you can get in with $1,000. Right. And then now you're an art collector of that piece. That's historic. It's huge value. And then also could potentially incur in value later on. I mean, we have cases in Dubai, this case called Mondi, I believe it was like 45 million and then it became 450 million after they sold it a bunch of times. So it's possible, things like that, right? But really the concept that's, I guess, other than profit and, you know, just being an art collector, I think the concept would be just democratizing art ownership. And that's new. I mean, people who are saying NFTs are dead, like how else would you do that? Please explain. You know, you can't do it.
How do the mechanics of that kind of sale work? Because if I'm going to spend $400 million on a painting, I want all the NFTs to be mine after that. Right. So how does that, what's the functional way that takes place? What's the way that it works?
Are you talking about if you as a buyer, or you mean you as the owner of the,
well, let's say there's a piece and there's 100 owners of a blockchain interest in that piece.
Yes.
And then the piece gets sold and those owners then collect because they're part of the ownership group. Yes. Do their NFTs then pass to the new owner? How do they, or do they just maintain?
Yeah. So this is also like very interesting concept. So technically that NFT should go zero. The time that they auction the art, you know, auctions, for example, for this kind of art that we're talking about usually happens twice a year. Let's say in some October time, this happened. And then technically this NFT, if it doesn't have any other utility, they should really go to zero and should just like, they should close shop. But it's really weird. It doesn't. So what happens is now, especially if the art was sold for some large number, now they can actually then, so now, obviously, the NFT no longer is giving them ownership to that art. Now, they can keep it, or they can burn it, or they can sell it. They have all these options. But you would think, so if it's not part of the roadmap of the project that they have to burn it, right? If they have to burn it, and by the way, burning in just so people maybe not don't know what that is, they would basically send it to a wallet that no one has access to. That would just be burning wow. the NFT, right? And it's not a person's wallet, by the way. It's just, right. It's like black hole of the internet, imagine, right? Now, if they don't burn it and they keep it, okay, obviously, like you use other utilities if there are any or not. But the ones that they actually sell it, now that's interesting because they could actually sell it for a larger price because this NFT was actually successful in actually providing some dividend or, you know, rewards to people. Even though it's already sold. Now, example of real life example of this is, NFT that I actually still hold, is from Gary V's. I was actually chatting with him a few weeks back, and I was telling him, I was like, hey, bro, like, what's the next thing? Like, you created this NFT. At some point, it was like $20,000. And then his NFT was giving access to events that he holds every year, right? Now, for each of the events, there are basically the tickets can come in they will come in a NFT format as well. But even though the events are passed, the NFTs are still valuable and people still buy them, which is very crazy, right? You would think like, why would, okay, so let's say you have the ticket to his event, and then I buy it to you after the event. Why would I buy it? Because I think someone else may buy it more expensive than, you know, than what I bought it. Right. So it just becomes it has its own, like its own path at that point. It goes into a different path.
It falls under memorabilia. It falls under memorabilia, right? It's not art per se, because it's just a ticket, but because it's about an event that happened, a historical event, then it becomes memorabilia. It's a link to the past.
Different
like,
reason. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's wild. So the NFT itself could take on a value life of its own, where originally it started connected to something tangible.
Yes.
That passes. Very good. And, yeah.
Very good. Yeah.
So how did Galaxy Pals Moon Pass do? Like, you sold through, but what's an NFT drop like that nowadays generate in rough figures? I don't want to get into your financials too much. No, but
So with the Galaxy Pals, we have two different mints. We have one that's a free mint that it already just happened about less than 30 days ago. And then we have a paid mint that's coming up in about two weeks-ish. That one is, I mean, usually I wouldn't want to say how much of a raise we're going to do, because we'll have to see. But usually in this time, now obviously when we get to let's say the peak of the bull run, things again go up. And it's a good comparison to what I mentioned to you in that 2021. But usually now, 300, 500K raises people do for primary, right? And then on the secondary, usually royalties is about 6 to 10%. And sometimes people do a little bit lower. We went through a time, collectively in Web3, we went through a time where no one wanted to do royalties. So secondary sales became actually completely like non-existent, but now we're back. So now we have royalties again in platforms, especially in Magic Eden. What can be expected? Well, you can expect from primary sales of the project somewhere around that, it's like a 300, 500K. And then secondary, it goes on until, you know, as you do more things with your community, then more people buy and sell, blah, 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 right? And then obviously it's not the only thing, because you could potentially have other things. It's a community built around that, right? You can sell, I mean, think about like, I mean, let's say Apple, right? So Apple sold, there's a community was built around, let's say, these like little MP3, you know, compact, whatever pocket thing they would call it, right? And then now we buy other things from them, right? So we buy like iMac, Mac, all sorts of things. So that, and at that one moment, that's the typical value you could expect.
Now with your free drop, the mm-hmm. Moon Pass free, eventually those could be worth value to the original collectors, right?
Yeah. So that's also very interesting. I mean, just like any free mint, there's like a, I mean, people should actually consider to actually prove this to themselves, but usually free mint about first day, they just go up like significantly, and then, well, significant to the value of a free mint, right? So
25 cents is still more than, it's 25 times what it was worth before.
Exactly.
More.
Exactly. No, that's right. Yeah. That's a good distinction. Right. And then it just drops to, and it just kind of levels out until something significant happens. So for example, let's say payment comes up, right? Because payment comes up again, that's it's connected to the free mint. So it could have potentially, some people may speculate and be like, well, that's gonna raise the value again. And people are not like coming in anymore to say, oh, I want to make, like, for one NFT, I'm gonna make a margin of like $10,000 anymore, right? So their concept is like, I have so many of these NFTs of free, and they're all going to go maybe a few hundred dollars. And then at least, you know, and then based even $100, right? And I have 10 of them, boom, like $1,000 took me like maybe 30 minutes to just buy and sell these. And then, so that's, there are people like that actually sculptors, they do these things, right? Your question was, okay, so how could the value go up? Yes, it could. And then how is it doing at the moment? We didn't go down. So obviously the first day went up and then it held its value. But having said that though, we purposefully wanted in our scenario, we could have done market making, for example, and then raised the value, right? And then the floor price would have been, for example, let's say we could have made it so that it's like $100, $500, right? Whatever. It's well within our capability to do that. But we purposefully didn't do that because the point of this free mint was we wanted people to get in, try out our utility, which is the signals, and get a feel. Like, it's like a free trial. Just like, you know, you buy into some subscription and then you just like, it's a free trial. I want to 7 days, try it out. Right. That was the point. So we actually, in a weird way, we were actually more encouraging people to sell it at a lower price because we wanted more people to get in and try it out. Right. This is a very specific scenario. I don't think this is the same for every collection because usually they do want it to go up because mm-hmm. then they can claim, oh, it went up and then now buy another one from us. But in our scenario, we were actually very confident about why people would want to buy is because they don't want to pay subscription. So if we show them that our services are being delivered and it's good, then they will buy. They don't care about like the pre-mint price. So right. that is, yeah, it's a different scenario, but yeah, that's where it's at.
Sounds like you were putting the value on audience, not on the yes. particular. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So you mentioned Web 3 and it's different from Web 3.0, which is just another iteration of the current sort of way that networking works. Web 3 is distributed networking. It's not really being adopted at a high level. What do you think the next level of adoption will be driven by? How do we create more Web3 kind of interactivity in the network?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, these, there's actually even like a, I saw a deck a few days ago. Someone was talking about like a Web 4.5. There's like 2.5. There's all sorts of things. So are you asking like
DAOs, distributed networks, right? The idea that the instead of having a central server that feeds everything out, we have the web constructed as a shared server with everyone as part of the node.
And then you're saying are you asking
what's like, going to create more adoption in your view? Because a lot of these things are based on this idea of Web3 being a new platform, a new way of information exchange that's decentralized and keeping people out of the clutches of gatekeepers.
Got it. And by the way, I love the fact that it's decentralized. I even sat on a panel with people from different banks. And then I told them, I was like, don't you think your operation is very inefficient? And then at the end, they came to me and they're like, wow, you really said that? I was like, yeah, it is inefficient. So I think it's perfect. You know, it's actually much better. You know, you want to take out some money from your bank, you just go in and, you know, they ask you so many questions. And then versus like, you know, you just want to take out money, like that's what you own, right? Now, how do we make it so that other people get it, right? I think one is if people know the real life utilities of the NFTs. In for example, we talked about real world assets tokenization. There is no other and or better way to actually do those things. The same concepts with the different technology. We do not have currently those, right? So I think if they understand that and they'd be like, okay, that's really cool. I can get behind that. Doesn't matter if it's an NFT or Web3 or token, whatever it is, right? Who cares? It's like saying, oh, I want to get, you know, I want to back some, let's say SaaS company, so service, essentially like a, let's say IT company, right? So, and then you'd be like, well, is this going to use internet? Well, who cares? Like, it's going to use whatever it's going to use, right? So, doesn't matter, right? So I think once we get past the, oh, just keep trying the same narrative and then, just trying to like force it down the, you know, down the community's throat. I think it's better if we just come up with, okay, what's the actual use cases, and then, and come up with even more use cases. And then the ones that already existing actually be able to explain it to people so people can actually use it. So I think that's one big, big way. The second way is, okay, well, there is a lot of businesses that they have existing model of providing service or products. If they actually look in to how they can integrate Web3, make it better, and that would mean make it better for the customer, make it better for themselves, meaning more money for themselves, or even more incentive for them, for the clients to buy, then these are the paths, I would say, that are easier to get the word out, as opposed to, let's say, I go on a panel, I talk about NFTs, or even whoever goes on the panel, right? I mean, even let's say Gary Vee has like a, you know, a lot of followers, right? I think he did bring a lot of people to at least take a look at NFTs. But then again, when his NFTs, he's kind of like not really engaging his own community, then people like not don't have a reason to really look at NFTs because of him, right? So point is, I don't think it's the people. I think it's the businesses, and then really the new creative ways of doing things. That's what's going to get people to just be like, okay, well, there's no other way than Web3 to make it happen. Right. And then, and obviously the last thing is just the, us having, I guess, ownership of our own assets, being able to control things to a level we want. And I guess maybe control sometimes has a negative connotation for people, but like really you should be able to control your own stuff. Like that shouldn't be a negative thing. Right. So I think those are the three ways when people would be like, oh, you know, I really, like to, get into, and they can get into, and this is interesting also, like they can, there are a lot of people got into crypto because of the overpriced, JPEGs. So they saw something, they didn't know anything about it. They bought it, they sold it, made money, and then they were like, oh, what is this I actually bought? And then they actually research it, and then they get into Web3 because of that, you know? So I think those are easier path for people like that, where it's a path for profit or path for getting some sort of benefit. I think those are the ways that like a lot faster, less resistance to get people on a mass level, and maybe there is a force against, you know, obviously the decentralization, because government will have more trouble. It will make sense, right? So to, for all governments to really do that. But then again, that doesn't mean anything. Like people will still be able to have their own wallets. So maybe they won't encourage it, but I mean, I don't think they could stop it is what I mean, you know?
I have a ton more questions, but I don't want to overrun my partner, Greg. Is it okay to go? Okay.
Yeah, go for it.
It occurs to me that beyond the NFT space, you said what you really do is marketing. And you've really exploited this particular arena of the market really well, and you're continuing to do that. But one of the things that's real about any product development cycle is the creation of the relationship with the buyer. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the kind of revolution in demand generation that we're experiencing right now, because it's a little different than it used to be. What is demand generation, and how do people who are entrepreneurs really maximize that in their lives?
Okay, cool. So demand generation is similar. I guess the equivalent of it could be just lead generation, except that term specifically is used typically in the B2B settings, mm-hmm. where, and especially even like larger deals, right? So Usually those kind of companies where they even hire for, let's say, demand generation expert is because they're looking for example, like one company I worked with, they had some of the largest banks as their clients, some hedge funds, and it would take a year, 2 years for that one deal to close. Right. And so it's a different type of marketing. You know, it's the usual marketer. They just think about, okay, well, I'm going to launch, some marketing. I'm just going to crank up some Facebook ads. By tomorrow, I'm going to get some clicks. And then let's say by, you know, same day or a few days later, I'll get some sales. Like that's very different concept to, you know, just we like, okay, what are we going to do for 2 years with this lead? You know? And there's a lot to do, you know, so you would email, ads, call them, friends, network with them, you network with them, you take them on a podcast, you go on their podcast, you send them a package, like as a gift or something, right? So you, let's say you go to their office, and then maybe network with their people, and then you bring some of their people back. Let's say just so many, you just keep thinking of like, and I would say maybe one distinct difference is, you know, how like in, last time I looked, you would need like, let's say 7 touch points. At some point it was like 12 touch points for some, let's say a buyer to see something and then buy it eventually. We were talking like in our case, we were talking like 60-100 touch points, right? And then just continuously just get on a call, and it's a very strange concept especially for me, like, you know, coming in from a, you know, more let's say faster sales cycle to coming and just be like, okay, it's been a year, we're still talking to these people, like what are we talking about? Then at the end, even they would just do a pilot for like, let's say 20% of their people. And, but that's how things are run on like large, like let's say largest banks. They want to do something. That's how things are run. They don't buy, like they just go on, let's say Fiverr or Upwork and then just buy it and then execute, right? That's not how it works. So that's the context, so people understand it first. And then the second thing is like, has that changed? And I would say, we have in marketing, I've gotten to the point where I'm realizing there's many more, I guess it's going faster than I can cover all of the content and learn everything. So then, so the game for a marketer, is going to be, okay, what is your little like bubble, your little niche, and then figuring out all those things. And then even just, combining forces with others who are in that industry to do even better. I think AI is going to make it even worse. Like I think, I was like looking the other day, so many content online. I just, you know, browse through to just understand like why people say things or like why some content works better than the others. And now I'm realizing how much content that's just AI. So as a person who wanted to actually get some, let's say answer to some of my questions, I had to go through so many videos to be able to even get to what I wanted, because it's just AI, and AI is not the same as, you know, like you guys asking me questions. It's just not the same. And maybe we will make it good down the line, but it's just not there. And so how that's changed is like, you can no longer basically add work, the market. It's just those kind of stuff that's like put more hours or put like, for example, I post more or like I email more or do these concepts are going to go away. And because you cannot compete, like some AI is going to do more. Right. So that concept has changed. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Web3 and blockchain technology will balance this automated aspect of AI where people can more readily identify it's AI generated and therefore move through it quicker to get to content they're really seeking?
Yeah. So I almost want to create some content based on this at one point, but the Web3 buyer is so much more sophisticated than a Web2 buyer. Now, they could be same person that just learn about Web3. It's not like a different human, right? Obviously, right. As in, like, it's not a different human characters. It's just a sophistication of that same person. But because things are so fast, so example of that, as a marketer in Web3, I assume everything that works only works for 2 months-ish, yeah. Right? So then that means, obviously things are a lot faster than the usual things, right? So I mean, just to give you a contrast, several years ago, there was this microblading salon I ran Facebook ads for. Actually, so a few days ago, they still use the same ads. It's been years. It's almost like a decade. And you can't do that in Web3, right? So the point is buyers, we, and I say we because I also buy into Web3 projects myself. So I say we're very sophisticated. And so we can, if we see the smallest, let's say, signal, and it's almost sometimes too exaggerated, to the point it's just annoying. Like on Twitter, for example, it's very annoying to even talk to people. The smallest thing that doesn't sound right, or it's just too good to be true, or smallest problem even, boom, like it's just as if like the end of the world, right? So example of that, for example, what we experience, let's say if it's a Web2 company, let's say monday.com is a service maybe a lot of people were familiar. They run a lot of ads. It's for organization of your tasks, you know, that's kind of stuff, right? So let's say if monday.com is, let's say they have a new feature, and this new feature is like a little buggy, right? No one expects, even monday.com with their, you know, just their capacity, their how large they are, everything. And by the way, I don't have a share in monday.com, so I'm not
sponsored by monday.com.
Yeah, yeah. But even with everything, all the resources they have, they, you know, you wouldn't expect them to, like, in 5 minutes to solve something, right? Versus Web3, literally 5 minutes past, everyone's angry, like upset. Like they're like, you know, you guys are not responsive. And we're like, this has literally been 5 minutes. And I've been on both sides, like provider and also the buyer. And so it's different psychology, you know. And would it balance it? I think it would, in a sense of just the Web3 buyers is looking for authenticity, you know. And maybe AI will be able to be authentic at some point, you know, because you can make it. If you're just like, if you work with the AI, you can make it. But if AI on its own doing things, it's not, you can tell, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, my son is entering the AI realm academically right now. And he was telling me last night that they're working with taking, I'm going to get the terminology wrong, but in essence, biological elements of a human body, like the neurons or synapses, and integrating them into computer boards.
That's trippy. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, I think that does open the door to this biological, natural element becoming a part of the programming.
Yeah. I mean, if they do, they'll be better than us. So I'll admit. I saw an ad. This is 5-6 months ago. I saw an ad of, no, it wasn't an ad. It was a YouTube, video of an AI salesperson, right? No disrespect to my salespeople, but that AI was better. And then I just imagined it and I was like, too soon. Like, I didn't want to know this. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's so good that you're like, wow, this AI is not going to be tired. Is not going to make mistakes, is just going to know your services like perfectly fine. Scary, you know, terrifying, because it could take our things. Yeah.
Do you think then for someone like yourself, there's an element of the tidal wave is upon us. It is happening.
Yeah.
And now we have an individual choice to ride the wave or get smashed by it.
Absolutely. I mean, the list is just use AI in every day, and then eventually, as I guess I purposely almost don't want to think about speculate on what could happen. But I hear like sometimes like Elon Musk talks about it, and it's like, well, it's kind of scary. I mean, just for myself, on a common sense level of just thinking of, okay, certain things that a computer could do that I cannot do. Okay, what does that mean? You know what I mean? Like it's definitely going to change the way we consume, we buy, we sell, like everything, you know. And to some extent it has already, you know, to some extent it has, right. but maybe there's more, they're just not really like unleashing, you know. So
all right, Arvind, are you ready? This is ready. The big offer.
Okay,
no one's thought of this before this moment, and I'm giving it to you. So welcome to the Moped Outlaws Incubator.
Okay.
Taking a group and building their own LLM and tokenizing the NFT ownership of it so that only members of the group, of the tokenized group, can access that AI. And then training it at a high level. So you're creating value with the fact that it's not a generic AI. It's not like, you know, OpenAI. It's specifically geared towards finance or something. And then you tokenize access to it. There's your $1 billion project. I expect you to send me the jet in 2 years. I want to come party with you in Dubai.
I think Mark just Illuminati confirmed.
The execution of that is going to be, quite a journey, but yeah, I mean,
it's out now. The world's heard about it. All 12 people that listen to our show have heard about it.
We should not publish this anymore.
Well, here's, hold on. You just thinking practically, one of the things my son brought up last night talking with him is energy, needed. So right now the energy involved with Web3 and blockchain is being talked about, how just and my son, his name's Jonah was saying, when people look at our mental capacity and even the processes, the energy expended to process light and the information to the brain, and there is a wattage that has been measured, but it's such a minimal amount when looking at the information being processed and sent. So I guess this isn't much of a question, but what I'm thinking of, there's biological elements that, as they're integrated into technology, I think it's going to match these challenges people are looking at.
Yeah. So I two thoughts on that. First of all, like, I have done it where, I mean, I learned this from my co-founder. Sometimes when he has like problems in his life, I mean, like everyone has, but he goes to ChatGPT and tries to solve it with ChatGPT, right? Wow. And it made me think, obviously, right? I was like, what if, like, so for example, like, I came up with this thing where I was like asking ChatGPT, be like, think about someone with an IQ of 200, and think like that person, and then answer me these questions, you know? I mean, they may not even let it, you know, go this far for certain things. They definitely restrict it, right? But then it has answers, you know, it has answers, and it's better than mine. I know that, you know, and the reason I know this is because, so I, as also a hobby, I researched a lot. I mean, my school time, I worked at a research lab, in psychology lab. And then, I was reading a lot of papers, and then, so I just got into just reading, understanding, you know, what the layout is, where to find the papers, how to read them, why you read them, all this stuff. So in the health, I read a lot. And specifically, again, because of my school time, and just there were some people that I was like, there's no way I can spend 24 hours just reading and reading. you still beat me. Like that's a problem, you know, like I cannot compete with this person, right? So I looked into early on, this is many years ago, I looked into nootropics. And you know, just the, so just for someone who never heard of it, I think it's at this point, it's very like common, everyone maybe know us. So nootropics is essentially supplements that, enhancing the mental, processes, right?
Right.
Now I've obviously, I can distinctly tell if, let's say I take a nootropic and then the way I think versus if I don't, right? If that's so, and this is my mind is already capable of doing these things, and all it takes is, because nootropics is not like a, we're not talking like, I mean, we're not caffeine. Talking like aliens or something like weird, you know, we're talking just some neurotransmitter in my brain that you actually may just naturally have more of, and then I'll just basically dose it up, and then now I can actually perform at a larger level than an average, at least average myself, right? And then, so that makes me think, I'm like, okay, if that's that much of a difference for me, with just my own, let's say neurochemistry, just being slightly enhanced, right? Slightly enhanced. Mm-hmm. And I see that much of that's that distinct of a change, in my, mental, capabilities. Imagine if, you recreate this in some sort of robot AI. And you just give it way more than my, you know, my, you know, brain is capable of, right? Then the pace at which we can go, you know, I think some people are going to listen to this, be like, these guys are mushrooms right now, but, there is just the pace at which things can go and just solve problems. And I mean, life issues, right? Like there's war, there's, you know, all sorts of problems. It's just
but the issue there
too much also, like we may just not want it weirdly enough.
Well, the issue there is you can create a processor that's more efficient, but you can't create wisdom. I think because wisdom is the combination of intellect and emotion, because it's fed by the experiences that of pain and emotional upheaval and pleasure that inform the thinking at a level that you can't duplicate. You can't mimic that, I don't think.
But that gets into, is emotion chemical, you know, because we're definitely studying chemical biology. And if I'm angry, what chemicals are released?
Yeah. And also, like if you watch, some of these robots that they've created that they talk, Sophie, I think is one of them. So they can understand. So even they don't naturally they're not naturally born with emotions, but once they understand it, they can then utilize it, which is very strange, right? So like they can utilize the concept of, so be like, okay, if I was sad, this is how I would do. Right. And then they can actually, they don't have to neurologically be sad. Right. But then they can act, and they know what that would look like in a human.
Yeah. Did you guys see that movie about that, guy who goes to visit like a Elon Musk person who invented an AI, and it's a woman, and in essence he falls in love with her?
Yeah. Machine X.
Yes. Did you see that?
I haven't, but that's trippy. Yeah.
Well, okay. This is a total
spoiler. Oh, no. Ex Machina, it's called. Ex Machina.
That's it.
Yeah.
And total spoiler alert, but in essence, he falls in love with the machine and at the end was completely manipulated. The machine just walks away without any emotional resonance, you know, like mission complete.
I've met people like that, but yeah.
That opens up another door.
That's funny.
Well, I think it's time for us to wrap this up, Arveen. It's been so, so fun to talk to you, and good luck with your comedy career.
The bear market is a lot more needed, you know, to alleviate the pain, but
We do have a question that we ask all of our guests, and it's the answer is really important to us. And so we're looking forward to the way you answer the question. And so the question is,
no pressure,
Eminem or Foo Fighters?
Eminem.
Wow. We've been getting a lot of M&Ms lately. Why do you say that? What is it about Eminem for you?
I mean, I just, I mean, I think, just, I think he's just like a, you're talking about the rapper, right?
Yeah. Marshall Mathers.
Yeah. I mean, he recently came to, UAE for watching some boxing stuff. I every time I see this guy, he's just, he's very, he's taken a path that's different to everyone else. And then he just very confidently just moves in that direction. And he's also producing things that's just very, you know, I would say pleasant to listen to. However, he did do an NFT and actually that went to zero apparently. But other than that, he's perfectly, you know, capable in like what he's up to. So I like him.
Let me ask you this real quickly.
Yeah.
So with that example you just gave where he created an NFT, it went to zero, but it's still alive, right?
I think so. I haven't looked to see where it's, because actually some Persian rapper just recently, literally, I think 3 weeks ago, did something similar and sold it for like 3,000, like at the floor price of 3,000. So like that's epic, you know, but, and it's like a well-known Persian rapper, but, I don't know how many he sold or how much he raised. I didn't really like, have that much interest to look into at that time. It's very interesting, but I just didn't at that time. But, Eminem's, from what I recall, this was a conversation even like I had maybe even a year ago. I'm recalling from what I remember. I'm maybe even completely wrong, but from what I remember, it was like a JPEG of something that he screenshotted, and then that had a lot of value, and then later on just became like very low in value. Same thing with happened with founder or previous CEO of X or Twitter.
The first tweet
or whatever it was. So something similar. So is this still out there? I mean, someone owns it, you know, it's still on the blockchain.
Mm-hmm. So there is the potential the value can come back.
Well, again, yeah, possible. I mean, one of the projects I flipped back in the day many times, the last time it went up for me to want to actually flip it was because Justin Bieber bought one or maybe more, but at least bought some NFTs in that project, and then boom, just went up. Same day. It's not really complicated for that price to go up. So I think he could potentially, I mean, Eminem, if you're listening, like this is your moment, you could actually fix that. But
contact Eminem, you'll set.
Yeah, exactly. So he could actually fix it. I mean, he just maybe doesn't care. And I wouldn't, in his scenario, I would stick to the, you know, the music, and he's just so good at that. But he could fix it. Technically, he could fix that. Build a community around it, give some twist of a value, you know, like something that people weren't thinking, you know?
Yeah, but that's interesting that you're using the word fix it, which it seems to me a very marketing perception of.
I didn't fix the problem.
Exactly.
You know, it's like low, right? That's what I mean.
Right,
yeah, but
right.
Yeah, it is fixable. Yes.
Right. That's what I'm seeing, is there's an element of marketing where you're thinking, okay, how do we fix the value of this?
Yeah, it's just a concept in Web3 mind that if the floor price is low, even though it's like a completely successful project, right? Price is low, it's a problem to fix.
Right. That's
like if it didn't sell out, but it raised like 10 million instead of 15 million, it's a problem.
That's funny. Because Mark and I, Moped Outlaws, has a collection on OpenSea. And right now it's an issue to be fixed.
Got it. Well, yeah. And you should know that we take our covers from our events.
Not anymore.
And we make them into single issue NFT artwork. Very cool. And so if you go to OpenSea and go to Moped Outlaws, you can purchase our collections. You know, they're all individual. We are interested in this space because we actually offer, like Greg creates these amazing artworks. Wow. And I think they're beautiful, and we're not asking too much for them. We really like to leverage them more effectively.
No, I love it. I love it. And it's just like a, it's like a moment, you know, that mm-hmm. that's just being captured in those. So it's pretty cool.
Well, and there's no audio. It's just the visual art that he creates that still, ends up being still, the, it's just the slate.
Whenever you captured is a moment, let's say, I don't know, a minute to 2 minutes, 36 seconds in, right? Or let's say if it's just the cover itself, like whatever, right? These are all just like a specific, it has a histor-, well, it will have a historical, let's say inherent value, because of just, it captured something at that, you know, that happened in the past. So yeah, it's cool.
So if we mint one from this episode, we'll let you know and make sure that you're included. But we, at this point, we don't have plans to mint. Oh, okay. You want us to mint one? Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep you in the loop on that. Cool. It's been really great having you here.
Yeah, and
I love that you are capable of seeing this as just a bear market and that you understand this idea of creating value as a universal principle. You've created a lot of value for me today in this conversation, and I really appreciate your time and energy, and I hope you'll stay in touch.
Absolutely. Yeah. Pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. And this is great.
Yeah. Thank you, Ivan.
Recording stopped.